"Worked for me," said Amy Weber, another squad leader. "I made a list of the things that I missed about Earth. It was sort of depressing, but on the other hand, it reminded me that I wasn't totally out of it. If you miss things, you're still connected."
"So what did you miss?" I asked.
"Well, Shakespeare in the Park, for one," she said. "My last night on Earth, I saw a production of Macbeth that was just perfection. God, that was great. And it's not like we're getting any good live theater around these here parts." "Yeah, I miss my daughter's chocolate chip cookies," said Jensen.
"You can get chocolate chip cookies on the Modesto," Key said. "Damn fine ones."
"Yeah, they're not as good as my daughter's. The secret is molasses."
"That sounds disgusting," Key said. "I hate molasses."
"Good thing I didn't know that when I shot at you," Jensen said. "I wouldn't have missed."
"Yeah, I miss swimming," said Greg Ridley. "I used to swim in the river next to my property in Tennessee. Cold as hell most of the time, but I liked it that way."
"Roller coasters," said Keyes. "Big ones that made you feel like your intestines would drop out through your shoes."
"Books," said Alan. "A big, fat hardcover on a Sunday morning." "Well, Perry," Weber said, "anything you're missing right about now?"
I shrugged. "Only one thing," I said. "It can't be any stupider than missing roller coasters," Key said. "Out with it. That's an order."
"The only thing I really miss is being married," I said. "I miss sitting around with my wife, just talking or reading together or whatever."
This got utter silence.
"Well, that's a new one on me," Ridley said. "Shit, I don't miss that," Jensen said. "The last 20 years of my marriage were nothing to write home about."
I looked around. "Don't any of you have spouses that joined up? Don't you keep in touch with them?"
"My husband signed up before I did," Weber said. "He was already dead by the time I got my first posting."
"My wife is stationed on the Boise," Key said. "She drops me a note occasionally. I don't really get the feeling she's missing me terribly. I guess 38 years of me was enough."
"People get out here and they don't really want to be in their old lives anymore," Jensen said. "Sure, we missed the little things. Like Amy says, that's one of the ways you keep yourself from going nuts, but it's like being taken back in time, to just before you made all the choices that gave you the life you had. If you could go back, why would you make the same choices? You already lived that life. My last comment aside, I don't regret the choices I made. But I'm not in a rush to make those same choices again. My wife's out here, sure, but she's happy to live her new life without me. And I must say, I'm not in a hurry to sign up on that tour of duty again either."
"This isn't cheering me up, people," I said.
"What is it about being married you miss?" Alan asked.
"Well, I miss my wife, you know," I said. "But I also miss the feeling of, I don't know, comfort. The sense you're where you're supposed to be, with someone you're supposed to be with. I sure as hell don't feel that out here. We go places that we have to fight for, with people who might be dead the next day or the day after that. No offense."
"None taken," Key said.
"There's no stable ground out here," I said. "There's nothing out here I feel really safe about. My marriage had its ups and downs, like anyone's, but when it came down to it, I knew it was solid. I miss that sort of security and that sort of connection with someone. Part of what makes us human is what we mean to other people and what people mean to us. I miss meaning something to someone, having that part of being human. That's what I miss about marriage."
More silence. "Well, hell, Perry," Ridley finally said. "When you put it that way, I miss being married, too."
Jensen snorted.
"I don't. You keep missing being married, Perry. I'll keep missing my daughter's cookies."
"Molasses," Keyes said.
"Disgusting."
"Don't start that again, sir," Jensen said. "I may have to go get my MP.
Susan's death was very nearly the flip side of Thomas's. A driller's strike on Elysium had severely reduced the amount of petroleum being refined.
The Tucson was assigned to transport scab drillers and protect them while they got several of the shut-down drilling platforms back online. Susan was on one of the platforms when the striking drillers attacked with improvised artillery. The explosion knocked Susan and two other soldiers off the platform and down several dozen meters to the sea. The other two soldiers were already dead when they hit the water, but Susan, severely burned and barely conscious, was still alive. Susan was fished out of the sea by the striking drillers that had launched the attack. They decided to make an example of her. The Elysium Seas feature a large scavenger called a gaper, whose hinged jaw was easily capable of taking up a person in a single swallow. Gapers frequented the drilling platforms because they fed off the trash the platforms shed into the sea. The drillers propped Susan up, slapped her into consciousness, and then reeled off a hurried manifesto in her general direction, relying on her BrainPal connection to carry their words to the CDF. They then found Susan guilty of collaborating with the enemy, sentenced her to death, and pushed her back into the sea directly below the platform's trash chute. A gaper was not long in coming. One swallow and Susan was in. At this point, Susan was still alive and struggling to exit the gaper from the same orifice from which she entered. Before she could manage this, however, one of the striking drillers shot the gaper directly below the dorsal fin, where the animal's brain was located. The gaper was killed instantly and sank, taking Susan with it. Susan was killed, not from being eaten and not even from drowning, but from the pressure of the water as she and the fish that had swallowed her sank into the abyss. Any celebration by the striking drillers over this blow to the oppressor was short-lived. Fresh forces from the Tucson swept through the drillers' camps, rounded up several dozen ringleaders, shot them, and fed them all to the gapers. Except for the ones who killed Susan, who were fed to gapers without the intermediary step of being shot first. The strike ended shortly thereafter. Susan's death was clarifying to me, a reminder that humans can be as inhuman as any alien species. If I had been on the Tucson, I could see myself feeding one of the bastards that killed Susan to the gapers, and not feeling in the least bit bad about it. I don't know if this made me better or worse than what I had feared I was becoming when we battled the Kovandu, but I no longer worried about it making me any less human than I was before.
Chapter 12.
Those of us who were at Battle for Coral remember where we were when we first heard the planet had been taken. I was listening to Alan explain how the universe I thought I knew was long gone. "We left it the first time we skipped," he said. "Just went up and out into the universe next door. That's how skipping works." This got a nice, long, mute reaction from me and Ed McGuire, who were sitting with Alan in the battalion's at-ease lounge. Finally, Ed, who had taken over Amy Weber's squad, piped up, "I'm not following you, Alan. I thought that the skip drive just took us up past the speed of light or something like that. That's how it works."
"Nope," Alan said.
"Einstein's still right. The speed of light is as fast as you can go, besides which you wouldn't want to start flying around the universe at any real fraction of the speed of light anyway. You hit even a little chunk of dirt while you're going a couple of 100,000 clicks a second, and you're going to put a pretty good hole in your spaceship. It's just a speedy way to get killed." Ed blinked and then swept his hand over his head.
"Whoosh," he said.
"You lost me."
"All right, look," Alan said. "You asked me how the skip drive works, and like I said, it's simple. It takes an object from one universe, like the Modesto, and pops it into another universe. The problem is that we refer to it as a drive. It's not really a drive at all, because acceleration is not a factor. The only factor is location within the multiverse."
"Alan," I said, "you're doing another flyby."
"Sorry," Alan said, and looked thoughtful for a second.
"How much map do you guys have?" he asked.
I vaguely recall calculus, I said.
Ed McGuire nodded in agreement.
Oy, Alan said. Fine. I'm going to use small words here. Please don't be offended.
We'll try not to, Ed said.
Okay, first off, the universe you're in, the universe we're in right at this moment, is only one of an infinite number of possible universes whose existence is allowed for within quantum physics. Every time we spot an electron in a particular position, for example, our universe is functionally defined by that electron's position, while in the alternate universe, that electron's position is entirely different. You following me?
Not at all, said Ed.
You non-scientists. Well, just trust me on it, then. The point is, multiple universes. The multiverse. What the skip drive does is open a door to another one of those universes.
How does it do that? I asked.
You don't have the math for me to explain it to you, Alan said.
So it's magic, I said.
From your point of view, yes, Alan said. But it's well allowed in physics.
I don't get it, Ed said.
We've been through multiple universes then, yet in every universe we've been in has been exactly like ours. Every alternate universe I ever read about in science fiction has major differences. That's how you know you're in an alternate universe.
There's actually an interesting answer to that question, Alan said. Let us take as a given that moving an object from one universe to another is a fundamentally unlikely event.
I can accept that, I said.
In terms of physics, this is allowable, since at its most basic level, this is a quantum physics universe and pretty much anything can happen, even if, as a practical matter, it doesn't. However, all other things being equal, each universe prefers to keep unlikely events to a bare minimum, especially above the subatomic level.
How does a universe prefer anything? Ed asked.
You don't have the math, Alan said.
Of course not, Ed said, rolling his eyes.
But the universe does prefer some things over others. It prefers to move towards a state of entropy, for example. It prefers to have the speed of light as a constant. You can modify or mess with these things to some extent, but they take work. Same thing here. In this case, moving an object from one universe to another is so unlikely that typically the universe to which you move the object is otherwise exactly like the one you left. A conservation of unlikeliness, you might say.
But how do you explain us moving from one place to another? I asked.
How do we get from one point in space in one universe to an entirely different point in space in another?
Well, think about it, Alan said. Moving an entire ship into another universe is the incredibly unlikely part. From the universe's point of view, where in that new universe it appears is really very trivial. That's why I said that the word drive is a misnomer. We don't really go anywhere. We simply arrive.
And what happens in the universe that you just left? Asked Ed.
Another version of the Modesto from another universe pops right in, with alternate versions of us in it, Alan said.
Probably.
There's an infinitesimally small chance against it, but as a general rule, that's what happens.
So do we ever get to go back? I asked.
Back where? Alan said.
Back to the universes where we started from, I said.
No, Alan said.
Well, again, it's theoretically possible you could, but it's extremely unlikely. Universes are continually being created from branching possibilities, and the universes we go to are generally created almost instantly before we skip into them. It's one of the reasons why we can skip to them. Because they are so very close to our own in composition. The longer in time you're separated from a particular universe, the more time it has to become divergent, and the less likely you are to go back to it. Even going back to a universe you left a second before is phenomenally unlikely. Going back to the one we left over a year ago, when we first skipped to Phoenix from Earth, is really out of the question.
I'm depressed, Ed said.
I liked my universe.
Well, get this, Ed, Alan said.
You don't even come from the same original universe as John and I, since you didn't make that first skip when we did. What's more, even the people who did make that same first skip with us aren't in the same universe as us now, since they've since skipped into different universes because they're on different ships. Any versions of our old friends that we meet up with will be alternate versions. Of course, they will look and act the same, because, except for the occasional electron placement here and there, they are the same, but our originating universes are completely different.
So, you and I are all that's left of our universe, I said.
It's a pretty good bet that universe continues to exist, Alan said, but we are almost certainly the only two people from it in this universe.
I don't know what to think about that, I said.
Try not to let it worry you too much, Alan said. From a day-to-day point of view, all this universe hopping doesn't matter. Functionally speaking, everything is pretty much the same no matter what universe you're in.
So why do we need starships at all? Ed asked.
Quite obviously, to get where you're going once you're in your new universe, Alan said.
No, Ed said. I mean, if you can just pop from one universe to another, why not just do it planet to planet, instead of using spaceships at all? Just skip people directly to a planet's surface. It'd save us from getting shot up in space, that's for sure.
The universe prefers to have skipping done away from large gravity wells like planets and stars, Alan said. Particularly when skipping to another universe. You can skip very close to a gravity well, which is why we enter new universes near our destinations, but skipping out is much easier the farther away you are from one, which is why we always travel a bit before we skip. There's actually an exponential relationship which I could show you, but...
Yeah, I know, I don't have the math, Ed said.
Alan was about to provide a placating response when all of our brain pals flicked on. The Modesto had just received news of the Coral Massacre, and in whatever universe you were in, it was horrifying stuff. Coral was the fifth planet humans settled, and the first one that was indisputably better acclimated for humans than even Earth itself. It was geologically stable, with weather systems that spread a temperate growing zone across most of its generous landmasses, and laden with native plant and animal species genetically similar enough to Earth's that they fulfilled human nutritional and aesthetic needs. Early on, there was talk of naming the colony Eden, but it was suggested that such a name was karmically tantamount to asking for trouble. Coral was chosen instead for the coral-like creatures that created gloriously diverse island archipelagos and undersea reefs around the planet's equatorial tropical zone. Human expansion on coral was uncharacteristically kept to minimum, and those humans who did live there largely chose to live in a simple, almost pre-industrial way. It was one of the few places in the universe where humans attempted to adapt to the existing ecosystem, rather than plow it over and introduce, say, corn and cattle. And it worked. The human presence, small and accommodating, dovetailed into Coral's biosphere and thrived in a modest and controlled way. It was therefore entirely unprepared for the arrival of the RAE invasion force, which carried in its numbers a 1-to-1 ratio of soldiers to colonists. The garrison of CDF troops stationed above and on Coral put up a brief but valiant fight before being overwhelmed. The colonists likewise made the RAE pay for their attack. In short order, however, the colony was laid waste and the surviving colonists literally butchered, as the RAE had long ago developed a taste for human meat when they could get it. One of the snippets broadcast to us via BrainPal was a segment of an intercepted food program in which one of the RA's most famous celebrity chefs discussed the best way to carve up a human for multiple food uses, neck bones being particularly prized for soups and consommés. In addition to sickening us, the video was anecdotal proof that the Coral Massacre was planned in enough detail that they brought along even second-rate RA celebrities to take part in the festivities. Clearly, the RA were planning to stay. The RA wasted no time toward their primary goal for the invasion. After all the colonists had been killed, the RA transported down platforms to begin strip-mining Coral's islands. The RA had previously tried to negotiate with the colonial government to mine the islands. Coral-like reefs had been extensive on the RA homeworld until a combination of industrial pollution and commercial mining had destroyed them. The colonial government refused permission for mining, both because of Coral's colonists' wishes to keep the planet whole and because the RA's anthropophagic tendencies were well known. No one wanted the RA overflying the colonies, looking for unsuspecting humans to turn into jerky. The colonial government's failing was in not recognizing what a priority the RA had made coral mining. Beyond its commerce, there was a religious aspect involved that colonial diplomats grossly misinterpreted, or the lengths that the RA were willing to go to undertake the operation. The RA and the colonial government had mixed it up a few times. Relations were never good. How comfortable can you really be with a race that sees you as a nutritious part of a complete breakfast? By and large, however, they kept to their knitting and we to ours. It was only now, as the last of the RA's native coral reefs choked toward extinction, that the extent of their desire for coral's resources came to slug us in the face. Coral was theirs, and we'd have to hit them harder than they had hit us to get it back.
"It's pretty fucking grim," Lieutenant Keyes was telling the squad leaders. "And it's going to be grimmer by the time we get there."
We were in the platoon ready room, cups of coffee growing cold as we accessed page upon page of atrocity reports and surveillance information from the coral system. What skip drones weren't blasted from the sky by the RA reported back a continuing stream of inbound RA ships, both for battle and for hauling coral. In less than 2 days after the coral massacre, almost 1,000 RA ships hovered in the space above the planet, waiting to begin their predation in earnest.
"Here's what we know,"
Key said, and popped up a graphic of the coral system in our brain pals.
"We estimate that the largest portion of RA ship activity in the coral system is commercial and industrial. From what we know of their ship design, about a quarter of the ships, 300 or so, have military-grade offensive and defensive capabilities, and many of those are troop transports with minimal shielding and firepower. But the ones that are battleship class are both larger and tougher than our equivalent ships. We also estimate up to 100,000 RA forces on the surface, and they've begun to entrench for invasion. They're expecting us to fight for coral, but our best intelligence suggests they expect us to launch an attack in 4 to 6 days, the amount of time it will take us to maneuver enough of our big ships into skip position. They know CDF prefers to make overwhelming displays of force, and that is going to take us some time."
"So when are we going to attack?" Alan asked.
"About 11 hours from now," Keyes said.
We all shifted uncomfortably in our chairs.
"How can that work, sir?" Ron Jensen asked. "The only ships we'll have available are those that are already at skip distance, or those that will be in the next few hours. How many of those can there be?"
62, counting the Modesto," Keyes said.
And our brain pals downloaded the list of available ships. I briefly noted the presence of the Hampton Roads in the list. That was the ship to which Harry and Jesse were posted.
6 more ships are increasing speed to reach skip distance, but we can't count on them to be there when we strike."
"Christ, Keyes," said Ed McGuire. "That's 5 to 1 on the ships and 2 to 1 on ground forces, assuming we can land them all. I think I like our tradition of overwhelming force better."
"By the time we have enough big ships in line to slug it out, they'll be ready for us," Keyes said. "We're better off sending in a smaller force while they're unprepared and doing as much damage as possible right now. There will be a larger force in 4 days, 200 ships, packing heat. If we do our job right, they'll have short work of whatever remains of the RA forces."
Ed snorted. "Not that we'll be around to appreciate it." Keyes smiled tightly.
"Such lack of faith. Look, people, I know this isn't a happy hike on the moon, but we're not going to be stupid about this. We're not going to slug it out toe-to-toe. We're going to come in with targeted goals. We're going to hit troop transports on the way in to keep them from bringing in additional ground troops. We're going to land troops to disrupt mining operations before they get going and make it hard for the RA to target us without hitting their own troops and equipment. We'll hit commercial and industrial craft as opportunities present themselves, and we'll attempt to draw the big guns out of coral orbit. So when our reinforcements arrive, we'll be in front and behind them."
"I'd like to go back to the part about the ground troops," Alan said. We're landing troops, and then our ships are going to try to draw Array ships away? What does that mean for us ground troops, what I think it does? Keyes nodded. We'll be cut off for at least 3 or 4 days.
Swell, Jensen said.
It's war, you jackasses, Keyes snapped. I'm sorry it's not terribly convenient or comfortable for you.
What happens if the plan doesn't work and our ships are shot out of the sky? I asked.
Well, then I suppose we're fucked, Perry, Keyes said. But let's not go in with that assumption. We're professionals. We have a job to do. This is what we're trained for. The plan has risks, but they're not stupid risks. And if it works, we'll have the planet back and have done serious damage to the RA. Let's all go on the assumption we're going to make a difference. What do you say? It's a nutty idea, but it just might work. And if you get behind it, the chances of it working are that much better, all right?
More shifting in chairs. We weren't entirely convinced, but there was little to be done. We were going in whether we liked it or not.
Those 6 ships that might make it to the party, Jensen said. Who are they?
Keyes took a second to access the information.
The Little Rock, the Mobile, the Waco, the Muncie, the Burlington, and the Sparrowhawk, he said.
The Sparrowhawk? Jensen said. No shit!
What about the Sparrowhawk? I asked.
The name was unusual. Battalion-strength spaceships were traditionally named after mid-sized cities. Ghost Brigades, Perry, Jensen said. CDF Special Forces, industrial-strength motherfuckers.
I've never heard of them before, I said. Actually, I thought I had at some point, but the when and where escaped me.
The CDF saves them for special occasions, Jensen said. They don't play nice with others. It'd be nice to have them there when we got onto the planet, though. Save us the trouble of dying.
It'd be nice, but it's probably not going to happen, Keyes said. This is our show, boys and girls, for better or worse.
The Modesto skipped into Coral orbital space 10 hours later, and in its first few seconds of arrival was struck by 6 missiles fired at close range by a RA battlecruiser. The Modesto's aft starboard engine array shattered, sending the ship wildly tumbling ass overhead. My squad and Allen's were packed into a transport shuttle when the missiles hit. The force of the blast's sudden inertial shift slammed several of our soldiers into the sides of the transport. In the shuttle bay, loose equipment and material were flung across the bay, striking one of the other transports, but missing ours. The shuttles, locked down by electromagnets, thankfully stayed put. I activated asshole to check ship's status. The Modesto was severely damaged, and active scanning by the RAE ship indicated it was lining up for another series of missiles.
It's time to go,
I yelled to Fiona Eaton, our pilot.
I don't have clearance from control, she said.
In about 10 seconds we're going to get hit by another volley of missiles, I said. There's your fucking clearance.
Fiona growled. Allen, who was also plugged into Modesto mainframe, yelled from the back.
Missiles away, he said. 26 seconds to impact. Is that enough time to get out?
I asked Fiona.
We'll see,
she said, and opened a channel to the other shuttles.
This is Fiona Eden, piloting